Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy! Friends, and welcome to season 2, episode 4 of Story of a Storyteller. I hope you're all well and happy as you can be. This week I am speaking with Jennifer Benson of New Berlin, New York. So she's just very new in general. Jennifer is a teacher like myself, and she has written her first book, Beautiful Possibilities, which is a memoir. Jennifer wrote about her years teaching in the Middle East, uprooting her whole life, and even surviving a tsunami. We talk about what Jennifer calls her inner ding, or that little, you know, voice inside of us all that tells us what's up, you're not happy here, this isn't right, that kind of thing. Jennifer decided to listen to her inner ding and left a well-paying teaching job near her home and family in 2001. Planning to be gone for a year or two at most, Jennifer ended up not returning for 13 years. We talk about culture shock, finding love, and having to make tough decisions, and it's a fascinating interview. In other news, I had a total fanboy moment, not once, but twice last week on Twitter. I'm sure most people listening to this podcast are avid readers, and they know about the website Goodreads. And Goodreads has this little option that you can give yourself a reading challenge for the year, and it's a big thing in January. You know, how many books are you aiming to read? And I'll be honest, the last couple of years I had Goodreads, and I felt I wasn't reading for enjoyment, but I was reading to achieve, which isn't suited to everybody. Might suit some, but didn't suit me. So I decided Goodreads just makes me feel bad for not reading enough, as opposed to celebrating what I have read. So instead, this year I'm tracking all the books I'll read in 2021 as a thread on Twitter, which brings us to my fanboy moment. The first book I read this year was Your Author Business Plan by the incomparable Joanna Penn, a hugely fascinating and helpful and amazing book if you are a fellow author looking to for, you know, your author life to be your primary income. And the second book I read this year was a fiction book, Home Stretch, by the amazing Graham Norton, host, actor, radio DJ, and author. He's just an amazing writer. And lo and behold, I tweeted about both of the books, and both of them liked my tweets, which kind of made me go, what? They're seeing these things? And Joanna Penn even replied and said, thanks, I'm glad it helped. And I'm not lying when I say I was on cloud nine for a day, maybe two, after seeing those responses. The one thing I took away from it was that no matter how famous or successful people are with their books, every single positive comment that you get about your book really helps. As for my own writing, look, I'll be honest, I have yet to put pen to paper in 2021. I know that's awful and it's dreadful and it's horrible, and there's the whole thing of you have to write every day, but guess what? No, you don't. You have to write every day that you can, and I just can't lately. In Ireland, I'm sure you've seen the news if you're not Irish, Ireland is unfortunately one of the higher places now for COVID-19, and schools were closed. Well, not so much closed as they were not reopened after the Christmas holidays. So the school days back in full lockdown, teaching via distance learning apps and WebEx calls and all this, it's a lot. And unfortunately, by the end of the day each day, I just cannot face more time in front of the laptop, so I'm just not writing. However, we've only a week and a bit done in distance teaching, so I'm hoping that I'll get into a new routine, and then once I'm in that new routine, I'll have the mental capability to start penning the sequel to my first novel, which is The Longest Night. But listen, you're not here to listen to me fanboy out and complain. You're here to listen to Jennifer's story. So, let's go and do that now. I recorded all of season 1 in the month of July.
And now I'm recording season two in bits, so I have big stretches between interviews. So I'm very, I get very nervous.
Oh, it's okay. I am too.
Oh, don't be. I'm lovely.
Oh, no, I know that.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Story of a Storyteller podcast. And my guest today is fellow teacher and writer, Jennifer Benson. How are you, Jen?
I am great, Connor. So nice to be here today. So thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. Jennifer, you have a really interesting story and I'm really, really excited to get into it. But this podcast is all about the beginning and the middle and the to be continued of an author. So we can't get to the middle until we do the beginning. Yes. So can you tell me a little bit about where you were born and what growing up was like for you?
Sure, I'd love to. I was born in Cooperstown, New York. So central New York area, you know, I don't know if I want to give the year, but it was back in the, 1970. And I grew up on a dairy farm, you know, with my parents. And we had a very tiny farm, but my mom was able to do a lot of different writing and different type of reading activities with me growing up with my sister. So she had flexibility in her schedule being a farm wife to kind of, you know, nurture my sister and I by reading to us and writing with us. And she'd take us on trips to the library, local library every so often and get books as well. So my mom was pretty good that way when we were growing up. And then at other times we'd go out in the tractor with her, you know, so, but we had a good balance there on the farm. So she made sure of that. Yeah.
That's really good. And can you remember any books like going to the library that, same, my parents, I grew up on a farm as well. And my parents, my mum particularly used to bring us to the library, but our local library was inside the secondary school. So I have this really clear memory of walking down this big, long, dark corridor to get to the library. But do you have any like particular books you remember getting from the library and getting really excited about? Or?
Oh yeah. With the picture books, I had a lot, you know, a lot of those when I was really little, but then, you know, as you get older, your focus gets a little bit more narrow. So probably around the age of around 8, maybe 9, 10, I started getting into the Nancy Drew and the Little House on the Prairie series. So I was really big into the series, especially about little girls or teenage, you know, young women or whatever. So I think those two are the ones that really stand out for me.
And those books are still going strong. I'm currently sorting our entire school's library and I'm coming across Nancy Drew and Little House on the Prairie and putting them up on that shelf because, you know, they're still good.
Oh, I love them. I read them still today. It just brings back so many warm memories, you know, and yeah, they're excellent. So I know those are the ones that really stand out for me.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. And was it just you and your sister growing up or do you have any other siblings?
Yeah. It was just the two of us and she's a little bit younger, but she also loved going to the library. And then think about it, my mom always sat down and did these activities with us. So we kind of got a sense there was an importance with creativity. She would sit down and draw with us. She would sit down and finger paint with us. She would sit down and, you know, have one on each of, you know, one on one side, one on the other and read to us and read before bed. And we had those structures and those, you know, different routines in place. So we knew that they were pretty important, you know, and just, you know, how we spent time together. And so, yeah, it was good.
And like both of us are teachers and I can't help but be like, ah, yes, points for Jennifer's mom, because that's the exact thing we teachers are always trying to get parents to do, like read to your kids, do a bit of nice creativity and fun stuff with them. And
yeah,
and for doing that on a dairy farm as well, because for people outside of the farming world, like dairy farms demand a lot of attention and time. So
yeah. They do. It's a 7-day week job, I remember, with both mom and dad. And she'd be out plowing, he'd be out doing milking the cows, and they would come in. We would be out in the barn with them, but we would come in like with my mom around dinner time. But my father wouldn't come in until 9 or 10 at night every night. So yeah, it was just a constant, you know, way of life.
It's a very hectic life. a very rewarding one too, so that's okay.
Yeah.
And so what was school like then for you, considering we're talking about being teachers and stuff? Like, did you love school as a kid, or did you find anything tricky, or did you just love it. I don't know.
You know, it's funny. I like school a lot, but I had a really tough time with school. And I don't know why that was. I don't know if I was distracted when I was younger, but maybe I didn't apply myself. And I didn't get really good with school, I guess you could say, or do well academically until probably even my high school years. I had a couple, I don't know if my parents really pushed it that much. They were pretty open. I know they wanted us to get good grades, but that push didn't really come until probably middle school, high school. But, and I had a couple tough teachers. I think almost every year it seemed like between first grade and maybe fifth grade or sixth grade, I had these older teachers that are about ready to retire. And yeah. I think they came down pretty hard on me, you know, and I think, I remember one in particular that really scared me. So I think a lot of the writing enthusiasm that I had, a lot of that creativity kind of went away for a while, and then it came back again. You know, probably around middle school when I had a fabulous English teacher. And then I think she brought it all to life again for me. And I had her for throughout middle school and a little bit in high school as well. So I think it was just the magic of that one teacher, you know, because I remember, in grade school, I'd be called lazy, you know, the old fashioned methods of trying to motivate. And I think that's how they were taught, you know, and I understand that. Just, it was just different back then on how they try to get kids to do better, you know, and I'm pretty sensitive. So I probably closed up more, you know, and then in middle school and high school, like I said, that one teacher really brought it back out of me again. You know,
it shows how important, like, just one difference in teaching style, because, you know, you had the older styles given out to you and calling you lazy and stuff, and that wasn't working for you. So if there wasn't that who had a different style of teaching, if that didn't happen, you may never have written a book.
Exactly. And she is actually still in my life today.
Oh, brilliant.
I know. She actually published a few books. We stayed in touch all throughout the years, even when I was overseas. And she just saw something in me, I guess. I don't know, but we always stayed in touch. She published three books. And I believe, she's working on poetry now. But I actually hired her to do the content editing of my book.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So she's right there. Yeah. I just love her. But yeah,
she's been there from the beginning.
Yeah, what's that?
She's been there from the beginning, really. She brought in your love of literature and English and reading and all that, and right through to editing your book. Like, that's...
Yeah, I mean, she's just been there like second mom, you know. And I just owe her so much. I really do. Like, thank God for her, you know. So
that's brilliant. Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So one thing I found very interesting about, I was reading through your website. I really go to town on researching for these interviews.
Oh, good.
And this concept of the inner ding comes up a lot, and it made a big change. You listened to your inner ding, and we'll talk about what that is in a second. And in 2001, you made a big change in your life. But before you tell us about the change, can you tell us what was life like in 2001 before you made that change?
Yeah, I'll definitely tell you. I was, you know, where I was teaching, I had gotten my three years in at one of the poverty schools I was talking to you about previously. And then I moved into a wealthier district, and it came with a little bit more of a pressure and a lot more stress. And I actually kind of missed the other school that I was at, the one that was a little bit more, what's the word I want to say? Yeah, disadvantaged. Yeah, that was a good way to say it. But at the same time, I was also in a long distance relationship with somebody that I met out of college. And we were going into, I think, our 10th year. And we were living long distance, and it just couldn't make it work. And I just think, you know, at that time, I felt very stagnant. Like something didn't feel right in my life. I'm like, and I didn't feel fulfilled. And I don't want to say something was really wrong, but at the same time, I really questioned where I was headed. And then that inner ding voice, you know, kind of started kicking in, you know, to tell me that, whoa, all right, you got to look here a little bit. We got to do a little bit of reflecting. Something's not right. And it kept going and going and going day after day after day. Yeah.
Mm. So what is the inner ding then? Like, that's, That's I know because I've read through, but I'd love to hear you speak about it. Like, what do you qualify as the inner ding?
Well, you know, I got that actually from a quote from Louise Hay, where she talks about, I trust my inner ding. Mm. And that inner ding, as she talks about it, and it really resonates with me, it's that inner voice that's inside you, that's always guiding you. But the trick is to listen to it and how to listen for it. So I would get my inner ding voice, you know, in quieter times, like maybe if I was driving to work and I didn't have the music blasting, I would hear these things saying, you know, something's not right. What do you want out of life, Jennifer? Like, what do you want to do? There's just something that's not. And I was always worried about my relationship, my boyfriend and I at the time. It was always worry, where is this going? And I got kind of fed up with that. And basically, I just asked universe, you can say God, your higher self, whatever you want to say, your inner wisdom, but where am I going? Do you want any changes for me? Is this where I'm meant to keep going and on this pathway? Am I meant to change? If I am, please show me the signs. Yeah. And that's where I kind of stopped. But then all of a sudden, you know, true to its word, you know, I was shown the signs. And then there's opportunities that came from that within months, I would say. Yeah. My sister was overseas working in Kuwait, and a job opened up at her school. And it was for like remedial reading, English as a second language. And she said, we have two positions here, Jenny. I think you should take it. And I was just like, what? But then I kind of, the more I thought about it, I started getting excited about it. Mm-hmm. And, she had sent home postcards of places that she was going. And like I said, for the first time, I started getting excited about life again. And I think that's another thing with the inner ding voice. It's like, I think you not only have to listen to it, mm-hmm. but there's signs in your body that I think also help bring it out. Like, for example, feeling excited, feeling, wow, hopeful that this could be something. I don't know what it's going to lead to, but I thought, okay, if I'm going to go, I feel really excited. Maybe I could do this. I don't know, but it's exciting. And then if I stay, I was like, oh, yuck. So it felt more freeing and it felt better and more joyful to actually think of going than it did to stay behind. I think it came down to that. And then I got some more signs, you know, my school gave me a year leave and everything seemed to fall into place. And I was shocked because it was, I wasn't even tenured. I'd only been there for a couple of years. And here I am, something, my inner voice kicked in, said, why don't you go ask school for a year leave? And then you wouldn't have to give up your job. And then you'll feel more safe and secure to go overseas for a year and just try it. And I did.
Yeah.
And I got it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, there's another lesson. Ask for what you want in life, right?
Yeah. I think that's a really important thing in general, because
yeah.
a lot of people, they have not so much the fear of rejection, but the fear like of being given out to when they ask for something. Have you ever heard of the artist? She's a singer, Amanda Palmer.
I haven't.
No, yeah. she has an excellent TED Talk and a book called The Art of Asking.
Okay, now that I have heard The Art of Asking, actually, but I didn't know her name. Yeah.
And she kind of goes along the same road, like that. I mean, asking, as long as you do it politely and not do it in a way that sounds like you're demanding. But asking, you're never going to get punished for asking. Like if the answer is no, it's not the end of the world, and you're not going to get a yes if you don't ask.
Right.
No. And it seems like you took that step by asking for the time off of school, because it sounds like that was the one, like, was that the one thing that stopped you moving? The fear of losing a job or not having that safety net?
I think it was, you grew up in a house where, you know, my father was always a half, the glass is half empty kind of guy. And you're always, always worried about his daughters and our security, and you're going to college. You're just planning on getting divorced someday. You're going to have to go to college and take care of yourself. So you always have that feeling of insecurity. I didn't want to be without a job and just to go take off. And I did have that really good job. That paid a lot better than my other one. And I felt like, okay, I just got this job. I'm not ready to lose it completely yet. But at the same time, I don't know what made me go into that office and ask my principal, but, and of course, and then I had to get accepted by the Board of Education. They had the final say. But I don't know if I would have gone overseas if I didn't get that okay. You know, so everything really worked out. It was just another one of those signs. Like, I knew I had to go in there and ask her. And it was always very hard for me in life to ask for what I wanted. Very, very hard. And I'm still working on that. So, you know, you try, you know, getting away from the people pleaser and, you know, that life is reciprocal. It's give and take. You know, I'm still learning that. But yeah, you know, it took a lot of guts for me to go in there. I was shaking in my boots, but I did it.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's all about, like, the definition of bravery isn't not being afraid. It's doing things despite being afraid. And everyone has a different, I don't want to say breaking point, but, you know, everyone has a different point of what's intimidating, what's scary. Did you find going in and asking for, here we call it a career break, did you find that scarier than moving day?
No, I think, well, maybe, because I knew what was at stake with that, this with asking. You know, moving, and you mean like moving and packing to get over there, yeah, kind of thing. Yeah, that I knew that by that point everything was set in stone. I'm like, okay, this is it. There's no turning back, you know. And I knew that my sister would be over there when I got there. She was going to do a second year over there, so I knew I had missed my sister Melissa when I got there. But you're right. I think that decision initially was the hardest, where, you know, you were going to, and I had to also talk it over with my boyfriend, but he actually, by that point, I think after 10 years, I think, you know, my, you know, what he thought was going to be more secondary, you know, just because of, I think I was at my wit's end and I was ready for a change. So I think just with all of that, but I think with when you take that leap in life and you listen to your inner ding, you know that there's going to be some sacrifice possibly, you know, there's going to be some loss, even though it's the best decision that you'll ever make. And God knows I didn't know where that decision was going to go. And I didn't know how long I was going to be over there. But I knew that I had a feeling there was going to be some loss. And of course, you know, my boyfriend and I did end up breaking up over it. But I was willing to sacrifice that because of just how long we had gone out and it wasn't moving, you know, wasn't going anywhere. And I'm like, you know what, for once, I have to focus on myself. I've got to do this. And if I don't do this now, I don't know if I'd ever would, you know.
Yeah. Before we go to talk about your experience in Kuwait and elsewhere before you left, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the inner ding. You said a second ago that it could be your inner wisdom or God or whatever. Like, what is it for you, if that's not too personal a question?
Oh, that's okay. You know, at the time, you know, I'm not a super religious person or anything, but I do believe that there is this universe or God force that's within us, that I feel like, you know, I am part God and God is part me, if you want to say that. But I feel like there's some a universal wisdom or God that is inside of me that kind of knows me very, very well and is always guiding me to the highest possible outcome, to the highest good of all, as I would like to say. And at the time, I didn't really realize that quite as much. But there was just this push. There's this push that you're getting from your inner wisdom. It keeps pushing you. And I think the universe itself is always evolving, ever expanding, ever, you know, getting better and better. And everything's always happening for the highest. So I think there's just that push, like, you've got to do this. And it bugged me day and night. I'd be going to work and I'd be thinking about whether I should take the opportunity. And it just, it's almost like nagging you. Just, yeah. It starts off as a whisper and it gets louder and louder and louder. And then you ask for the light, the green lights. Okay, if I'm going to do this, I need signs that this is the right choice. And if it's not the right choice, please stop me. Yeah. Please stop me. I just came right out and asked. So once these green lights start showing up, first of all, you get the opportunity. Like my sister told me about the job. I asked for more signs, you know, and I got more green lights. And everything fell into place, and it almost fell into place very easily, very easily. And then I knew also that that was a good decision because it was almost too easy.
Yeah.
Everything was so smooth. Like
the fact that everything fell into place,
yeah, it
was probably more welcoming and less scary to take that. Because huge change. I mean, you literally moved to the other side of the globe. I mean, you changed you change from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, you change from the eastern to the western, or, you know, like the western to the eastern. So it was a huge change. So then what was that huge change like when you, I know you said your sister was there, and I'm sure she was a huge support and help. But like when you got to your apartment or wherever you were living in Kuwait and you put down your bags for the first time, what was going through your head?
Well, yeah, my sister was going to come back with all the rest of the returning teachers. So I had a week by myself with all the newbies, all of us new teachers there. So they drove us to our apartment. I mean, the principals welcome you at the airport. They put your bags in trucks. They drop you off. And yeah, you get into your apartment and you're like, and then I remember hearing the mosque at 5 a.m. and we were told that you're going to hear it. But that first time that you hear that mosque, you're like, oh my God, I'm not at home. I'm not even anywhere near home, you know, but I liked it. But they kept us so busy. We were working in our classrooms during the day, and at night they did a lot to try to get you to know all the other new staff, because you become family. Those people become your family because you're away from home. So we went out to dinners together. We went on trips to IKEA together. We went to the golf. Yeah, just to get our apartments. They provide everything, but there's always a couple things you need. So, and then we went to trips to the golf to go to the beach on the weekend. So we're just constantly, and they keep you so busy. It's almost like you forget that you are in another country. It's the strangest thing. It doesn't hit you until probably weeks later. And you're like, oh my gosh, you know,
And yeah. the other teachers you were with, were they mostly American like yourself, or were they from all over?
Yeah, this was an American international school in Kuwait. So they were mainly American and Canadian. It's they had these job fairs in America and Canada. So that's where the principals go and you know, the superintendent, they go to these job fairs and they pick up, teachers that are mainly American, Canadian. We had a couple from different, like from Britain and maybe Australia, but not many. Yeah.
That probably made it less like the chance of getting homesick in that first year was probably lessened by that, I'd imagine. You know, you're not.
Yeah. And it was good for my sister to be here. And yeah, there's teachers there and you just got to make your own fun. You would get together. We'd have game nights in our apartments and, you know, board games. And then we'd go out on shopping trips and stuff. I mean, it was pretty limited and, you know, you didn't have the variety, you know, obviously it's a small little country, but there were some malls and stuff, but yeah, you kind of have to make your own fun. We would celebrate the Canadian Thanksgiving and we would do our Thanksgiving and have everybody. So yeah, you just have to make it, you know, especially with holidays and stuff and not having your family, you have to kind of put in the effort to maintain tradition, your own tradition while assimilating in a new culture.
It's really interesting. I've never lived in a different, well, I was born in one country and grew up in another, but I've never lived in a different country as an adult. So I always find this really interesting to hear how people merge these two cultures and ideas and society. So it's really interesting. And then what was it like teaching there compared to home? Did you feel, like, I know it was an American international school, so it was same-ish curriculum and all that kind of thing. But was there anything hugely different? Was there any, from the teaching perspective, was there any huge culture shock for you?
You know, I don't, probably not as much as I thought, because the kids there at the school, since it's a private school, they learn English, you know, from kindergarten. So by the time they got up to me in fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, I would have these little pull-out groups. And they really were not that, their English was quite good. You know, it was basically like, because they were bilingual, there were things that I had to tweak up for them or whatever. But the biggest thing that I found interesting were all the varieties of culture, of countries that I had. I had kids from Lebanon, Kuwait, Korea, India, Bangladesh,
everywhere. You know,
and having that variety, I just loved it. And just the, just all the different perspectives and things, and they were very, very respectful for the most part. And the parents were very respectful. I love that. They were so appreciative of you, and you know, and they treated you quite well. I have to say that. Yeah, and the kids were great. We had Halloween. They celebrate a lot of our cultural things, probably because it was an American international school, but. we would have all these big Halloween parties, and the kids would bring their, have their drivers go and fetch them a bunch of food and bring it in. And oh my gosh, we had a blast. Yeah.
That's brilliant. So it sounds like after leaving this relatively well-off school in New York and then coming to this school, which was probably more well-off by the sounds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where you clearly felt, even just listening to you speak and your face is lighting up talking about it, so you clearly felt more fulfilled teaching there. So looking back now with hindsight and all that, can you pinpoint what it was that was more fulfilling teaching in Kuwait compared to teaching in the school you were in at the time in New York?
Yeah, you know, I think kids over there, and it's just because of the experiences, you know, and they move around. Some of them move around a lot. The Kuwaitis and the Lebanese tend to stay right in Kuwait, but you know, you have your kids from other cultures that the parents will get a job, just like, you know, with other expats, and then they tend to come and go. But for the most part, the kids seem very, very open-minded, you know, and they're so, what's the word I want to say, appreciative of other cultures. You know, you could have kids from 20 different countries in the room and they wouldn't even blink an eye. You know, we're just all part of Miss Benson's class. We were all sitting in here talking about a novel, and they just, you know, it's pretty amazing, you know, and they tell you what they like and what they're interested in and what they watch on TV. And it's just, and the trips that they take on their break, oh, we're going here, we're going, you know, and it's just amazing because they're all flying around the world and, you know, learning. And, you know, I was always in awe of how they treated each other. And, you know, like, it was just like a normal thing. For me, it was so not normal just to see that. And I loved it. But for them, it was just, oh, there's, you know, 20 kids of different nationalities. It's great.
That's one thing. I mean, because I worked with a woman for a couple of years who was one of those kids going around from one international school to another, because both her parents worked with the UN. So she, as a result, she was moved around a lot. And I remember she said to me, because I was asking about this, because I mean, I moved around a lot from school to school growing up, but it was all within Ireland and it was all within two different small counties beside each other. So it wasn't a huge deal. But you know, like, one school can be drastically different to the other. But she said there was something about her relationship with all the other kids in these international schools, was they all had that common experience of moving around a lot and of, oh, well, I'm in another country and I have to learn another currency and I have to learn another kind of small basic customs. Like, when you're going in and out of shops, do you say hi and thank you or not, and all this. So I suppose they all had that commonality, which makes them bind together, I guess.
Yeah, they have to be quite resilient. They have to develop that resiliency, you know, and it's not the easiest thing in the world. And now that I'm back home again, and I get those kids from coming from other countries, and I tell them, I know exactly how you're feeling. Because at first, when you do move to another country, you feel quite invisible. You know, you don't have your people yet, you know, your tribe, I always call it, you know, my little group of friends or whatever. And then I said, you also, like you said, you have, there's cultural differences, learning language. Kuwait and Qatar, the schools that I taught with, were very religion oriented, you know, so you really had to be kind of a part of that world, you know, even though you might not have had that, been in that religion, but it was a huge part of your life. And then going through the red tape, you know, and they would always talk about how their parents have to, you know, figure out how to go and get their driver's license, how to go, where do you go to get the best, you know, groceries? Where do you go to, you know, get your residency papers? And luckily for us at the, you know, teachers, we always had somebody called a mandub, and he would be the school liaison between the school and the Kuwaiti government. So he would take around and do all that. But a lot of people didn't have that. So they're there on their own trying to figure things out. But I always knew how they felt, you know, and especially, like I said, the kids here, I know what that's like.
And for those listening again, outside the teaching world, that's actually still kind of the norm for teachers, that international schools, it's a big thing here in Ireland at the minute. Before we were recording, I was explaining to Jennifer that teachers in Ireland who qualified after 2011 are paid at a much lesser rate than teachers who qualified before, and as a result we have a teacher shortage, because what all the post 2011 graduates do is they get a job for 2, 3, 4 years in extremely well-paying schools in like Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia and the UAE and all these places. So that's, there's a lot of, and there's a lot of Irish teachers go over there, but now they're crying out for teachers so much. What's actually happening is you're paid and they have an apartment for you and they pay your flights and they pay for everything once you get over there. Like it's so it seems like that's always been the norm, that these countries need these teachers from other countries because they don't seem to have their own for whatever reason.
I know in those countries that there were the Kuwaitis and the Qataris did not, and just from my own personal insight, they did not go to college to do that. And a lot of them were the wives of husbands who had, you know, million-dollar businesses and stuff, or they would tend to be at home more. And it was just, you know, and some of them worked, had jobs, but I never saw it as teaching, more or less. And there were some Lebanese families where the mother was teaching, and that when they were at the school. But yeah, I think it just wasn't, they just weren't into those teaching professions, you know, by within the country. So they would hire people to come in and teach the kids. Yeah. And you had to have a couple years experience and you had to have your credentials. So depending on the school that you're at, and, you know, but I know Qatar paid a lot more than Kuwait. You know, when I went down there, my salary almost doubled. But like you said, they pay for everything, you know, and it makes it very attractive.
Yeah.
And I didn't stay for, 13 years. And then there was a point where I'm like, all right, that's it.
Before we get to your return journey, I want to talk about another journey you did in between, which was could you tell us where you were December 26, 2004?
I'll give you a little backstory to that. My sister left Kuwait my second year, and a guy took her place, teach French, and that was a guy that I would be dating eventually and marry. So David and I were on the beach in Thailand in Raleigh, which is off from Krabi, one of the provinces. And we were on the beach one morning, and on this December 26th, and the day before we had been out kayaking, actually a few days prior. That's what you do. You go there, you get up, have breakfast, and you go out and kayak. But that particular morning of the tsunami, David and I are early risers, so we always got up at 6 or 7, even on vacation. That day of the tsunami, we got up, and I looked at the clock, and it was almost, I think it was after 8. And we're like, oh my gosh, we better get going because it gets hot, you know, and you don't want to be out there. So we hurried up and got our stuff, went down, had breakfast. David walked over to the dive shop, and I was kind of people watching. And then the waves, all of a sudden, the waves got sucked way out, and they started forming this like turbulent wall of water. And people started standing up, and they were wondering what it was. They walked all the way out there. All the boats that were in the water were stranded. They were in the sand. And I noticed there were two Thai waitresses behind me, and they were holding onto each other, and they started crying. And I'm like, something is not right. It's almost like they sensed it. But everyone just kept walking out, wondering, what is this strange metamorphosis of nature? What could this be? And we felt like we had to know, you know? So they kept walking out. And I don't think Thailand ever had anything like this before. So the Thais didn't know what was going on. The expats, we didn't know what it was. We didn't know that there had been an earthquake. So finally, the first wave started coming in. And I had, and David was over there taking pictures. But the first wave started coming in. And the only person on that whole beach was a dive that knew what was going on. The dive instructor just happened to come outside and looked at what was going on. She said, it's a tsunami, run, run. It's a tsunami, you gotta get out of here. God. And thank God for her, you know? Oh. So, and then David grabbed my hand and we just ran back up to where our hotel was. Our hotel happened to be way up on a cliff type area. So yeah, we just ran up that way, and I could hear people screaming behind me and things breaking. And I don't know, it was basically trying to outrun the tsunami is what you're doing. Yeah.
How long from when you first saw those waves recede, how long was it until the tsunami hit, until it came in?
It came in within seconds. So I think, you know, for me, you know, I think we watched the waves probably form a wall of water for about maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But the time from the first wave coming in, I couldn't even tell you. It was just seconds. It was just seconds. But the wave was on its way. I would say, I can't even tell you how many in yards, maybe like 100 yards from me. Okay. And luckily we were running uphill. So I think that kind of helped out with the, you know, where the water was going, because I've seen videos of it where it just went whoosh right across the whole island, yeah, like within seconds. But I think the fact that we had a little bit of a head start and we were running uphill, I think that, you know, and then when I heard people like crying and things breaking and screaming, I remember telling David, go on without me. I can't do this. It's almost like you're in this bad, everybody reacts to fear differently. And I felt like my legs were paralyzed and I couldn't go anymore. And I'm like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And he just grabbed my hand and just, you know, he's like, you're doing this. And so we luckily we got up there, but there was a meeting place where everybody was, you know, kind of ran to. So I had pictures of that as well. Our faces were red, you know, we're just standing around in shock. The Thais went and got life preservers on. I think they thought that the, you know, that there might be second, you know, what do you call that? I'm trying to think of what you call that, where you have another round of tsunami waves.
Resurgence?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I'm trying to, I have the name in my head and I can't think of it. But they thought there would be another round. So they were walking around with life preservers on, thinking that they're going to get hit again. So, and it just took a long time to contact family because all the internet lines, you know, everything, all the internet connections were down and the phone lines were down and we just didn't have any way. So, our, you know, my parents back home were, so yeah, it was just a big, awful, terrible mess, you know. Yeah.
Because I really clearly remember it because I don't know what you call it in America, but the 26th of December here is St. Stephen's Day.
Okay.
Or we just, we get rid of the saint and it's just Stephen's Day. And, like I just remember because Stephen's Day is always in a wee bit nicer than Christmas because there's less of the stress of, come on down, let's open the presents and then let's go cook the dinner. Like it's much more chilled. Yeah. And it was, I can't even remember how we heard because we wouldn't really have the news on Stephen's Day or Christmas Day. I think it was just somebody did have the news and then they text their friends and then they text their friends. And
yeah.
One of my parents got a text saying, why did you hear about this tsunami? Because it was just so bizarre. It felt like Christmas stopped because like thankfully we didn't know anybody and or anything like that, but it was just such a huge, huge thing. I mean, that one tsunami hit countless countries and took countless lives and it was just such a world, like I feel like the world stood still for a second and watched, do you know?
Yeah, I heard that one was the biggest one ever. In the waves, some places were 500 miles an hour. So I look back on that now, and to this day, I can't watch any tsunami movies. You know, I think it's almost like the shock that never leaves you. You know, you're like, I went through that, that doesn't seem possible, but and it's funny, when David and I got back to Kuwait, we went to Bangkok for a while once the boats were finally up and moving a few days later. But when we got back to Kuwait, he was teaching high school math at that point. And one of his students, his father, of course, in Kuwait owns a television show. Oh. So he actually had us on. It was called Starting Over. Oh, so we could talk about the, so that was another first experience for David and I to be able to go on a Kuwaiti talk show. And talk about our, you know, tsunami experience. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, you look back on it now and yeah, it doesn't seem possible.
Yeah, I remember reading sometime later that the earthquake that caused the tsunami was so intense. Now I'll have to look this up to make sure I'm not making this up. That it was so intense, the earth lost 1 second of rotation. So like the planet stopped rotating for just a second because the earthquake was so intense. So just
like, yeah,
it's huge.
I know. Talk about it like a shift and a, you know, it's, yeah, yeah, it was really powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of things. Luckily, we slept in. Luckily, there was a dive instructor. I mean, we were extremely lucky that morning. And I think that's why it always bothers me since then, you know, yeah, the fact that we might not have been that lucky. And I think a lot of the the people that lost their lives around Thailand were out on those boat excursions. They take these small boats out and you go to this these little islands, you know, for the morning or the afternoon. And then the posters that came up afterwards, have you seen? So there might have been like a fan, you know, a mom with the kids while the father went diving. You know what I mean? Like, and you know, that the father's okay, but then that, you know, like there was a lot of that kind of stuff just because of, you know, parts of the family went to this destination and some were doing this and they were, you know, misplaced from each other, you know, and they never got back together. You know, and there's a lot of that and a lot of ties. And I know in Indonesia and Sri Lanka got hit hard, and I heard it went all the way to even to Africa, but
yeah.
It was just quite shocking. Yeah.
It's a huge, huge world changing event. And I think, because it's 16 years ago now, like it's a good while ago, but I think we sometimes forget individual stories like yourself and your husband, you know, that these things affected individuals, and not just individuals but families. I mean, if one woman and her children were looking for their husband, I mean, that's also somebody's son, somebody's brother, somebody's uncle. Like it's more like the wave. It had this ripple effect around the world, you know.
And that's when it really bothered me, is when I saw the faces of, when it's one thing to hear names or how numbers or how many, but when you see a face,
yeah,
those faces just stayed with me, you know, and I can still see some of them, you know. So yeah, it never leaves you. And then you have this, you know, it could have been me, you know, a lot of that, which you'll always have. But yeah, it's just, and I heard over 200,000 that died.
A huge number. But thankfully you kind of got out of there, and you know, I believe then soon after that you moved to Qatar then, is that correct? And you changed, and you mentioned earlier your wage doubled.
I call it, I shouldn't say this, but we had a friend down there that said, why don't you just come down here? And you think it's going to be so similar because Qatar and Kuwait are right next door to each other. But when we got down there, I was turning 40 that year. And I think, you know, we were in a pretty rough school. The school was I don't want to say too much about it, but I call it a naughty boy school. It was like a boarding school for boys. And I think it was like grades 6 through 12. And, you know, I'd always said in Kuwait, I just want to be paid for my stress, even though, you know, at times it was stressful. I think you got to be careful what you wish for. When I got down there, you know, and the boys were not, you know, I think it just, I worked on it for like 3 months to try to get them to come to class on time. But I think they were coming from public schools where anything went, you know, they were, it was not the traditional classroom environment like it would be at private international schools or here schools back here. They weren't used to asking permission to go to the bathroom or, you know, whatever. But anyway, let me just say, after 3 months it was fine, you know. But there were a lot of teachers though that weren't so lucky. It was just I think the whole school itself was very, very stressful, you know. And I think that really put, you know, a lot of pressure on David and I, you know, and I think eventually within 4 years of living in Qatar, we even switched schools. We thought maybe that would be better, but I never could figure out, was it Qatar? Was it that I started wanting to go home? Is it I miss Kuwait? Is it I'm done with international teaching? Like there's something started happening around the age of 40, and I hung on for 4 more years. And I think it was just out of love for David, you know, that I wanted to give it a go. He was so happy overseas. And then I think my body just kind of ended up giving out. I couldn't take it anymore. I needed to go back home. Yeah.
So that was your inner ding signaling again.
That's my inner ding. And that one, my inner ding that last time was about 4 years long. You know, and I'm like, if I go home now, I'm going to end up losing David. David's from British Columbia, Canada. There's no way he's going to want to live in New York. And he pretty much had told me that a few times, but, and he loved living internationally. So I'm like, okay, if I stay, I lose Jenny, myself. If I go home, I lose David. And it was just not a choice I wanted to make for about 4 years.
Yeah. But finally, it's a hard choice to make. I mean,
yeah. Know,
So obviously you ultimately chose Jenny.
I did. And I tried one more place with him. I actually went to, and I didn't tell you about that originally, but I went to Manila and I tried the Philippines. And no, I did not.
Well, you tried.
And that's what I said. I tried, but that was heartbreaking. Once again, I had to leave David. It's like, I was willing to almost do anything. I thought, okay, maybe it's the Middle East, maybe, you know, but I was ready to come home, and I couldn't lie to myself anymore. I had to be true to myself. And, but everything, you know, as soon as I got home, everything really started falling in place again, you know. And I think overseas was good for that time, and I was meant to go there, but I had an expiration point for, or exclamation, or what did you try to think?
Expiration.
Well, you know, David just bought a house in Manila, so he's at a really good school. He loves it. He's thriving, and
so he's still there now, is he?
Yeah, he's still there. That's ever since 2015, so he's still there. You know, and we still talk. He's doing well, and I'm really glad for him. And that's what I wanted. I wanted for him to be happy, and it's tough though when you love each other and you want what's best for each other, but you know, at the same time, it may not necessarily be with each other, you know. You might have to move apart to do that, but we had to do that. And like I said, once again, making those leaps and listening to the inner ding, sometimes there's sacrifice, there's loss, you know. And even though it was the hardest decision to ever make, it turned out to be the best decision. But that's how sometimes those decisions, you just don't know how it's going to turn out, but then it ends up turning out, you know. But it's hard to see down the road that far, but I guess, you know, you don't have to have it all figured out. You just like, okay, this is what I don't want. That's all I know. I don't want to be overseas. I'm going to take a risk, and I'm going to go back home and be with family again and see what life has in store for me. You know?
I think it sounds to me, just from listening to your story and listening and even watching how you speak, that it's a testament to how much you cared for and loved David that you not ignored, but you didn't listen to, as you're calling it, the inner ding. For it seems like you ignored it for much longer than the first time that it summoned you to wait. So I think that's it shows how much more difficult of choice it was to, you know. You wanted David to be happy, clearly, but it sounds like a part of you knew, well, if he's happy here, then I'd be sacrificing my own happiness by staying.
Yeah.
And it's a very sad, but also strong and brave decision to make once again, you know.
Thank you.
So then you returned to the US after 13, was it 13 or 14 years away?
13 years. Yeah.
It's a long time. So when you
return, it's still normal now, but yeah, that's crazy amount of time.
And like, I'm sure you were over and back during those 13 years, and like for Christmas or every now and then or whatever.
Oh yeah. David and I came home for one Christmas. So I was only home for one Christmas. All the other Christmases are like going to Thailand on the beach, and some guy, Thai guys dressed up like Santa, pouring shots in people's mouths. I'm like, you know what? I think I'm ready to go home and have a traditional Christmas, you know? But yeah, you're right. I mean, we came home like in the summer, and he'd go to his parents' house and I'd go to mine. So yeah,
So when you moved back, was there like, obviously you had to deal with the gradual breaking up of your relationship with David, unfortunately, but once you were back, was there any big culture shock again, like coming home?
Yeah.
Did you find any big changes or anything wasn't as you remembered?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. There is a little bit of that, because you're like, did I go over there for nothing? You were wondering why that, what that, the value of all that experience was, you know. And I'm coming home without David, I'm coming home without a job. So I kind of went sunk down to that really low level of, okay, I'm 45, I am completely starting all over again in life. And I don't know what I'm going to do. I did get a job that helped a lot. And I was around family. And one of the big things that I was missing overseas was nature. being around nature again. I mean, that's how I connect with my spirituality, I think, a lot. And being without that, being without fall, being without my pine trees, and being able to go for a walk, you know, and wear shorts, and there was, and drive again. I didn't really drive that much overseas. I just didn't feel like it. I could have done it, but just having a lot of those different little freedoms back. But yeah, starting over again as a single woman again, or a divorced woman, you know, I mean, eventually we got divorced, but yeah. And it's scary, I think, sometimes, because you think, oh, I'm going to be alone forever or whatever. But I think the biggest lesson from that was I had to work on myself. So I started doing some meditation in the morning, and so a lot of affirmations, and everything kind of, you know, being on your own. I was on my own for about 4 years. And I think I really used that time to build up my life again and build up my foundation and love me again, you know, to try to get rid of that guilt, you know, that I felt for leaving David. So I think it just takes a long time, you know, and David and I kind of stayed in touch. We tried to make it work. And then 2019, he wanted a divorce. And then, and it's so funny, about within a month, I was at a gym working out, and I met the guy that's in my life still to this day. So I think once I signed off on those divorce papers, I think the universe was saying, all right, then you're finally ready. Let's do this. You know, so that was about 4 years after David and I split up. So,
okay. Yes. Yeah, so it's a long time too. But it's again, it sounds like, I think one theme I'm getting out of our whole conversation is the importance of listening to what you need in order to be happy. I mean, you needed to a change up. You needed to come home. You needed those 4 years on your own, you know, and you strike me as a very centered and warm and cheerful person. So it seems like listening to yourself works. So
thank you. Yeah, it does. It does. You think it's not going to come together, but it really does. It really does. And I was so glad for that time on my own. And I had everything I needed. I had a job. I had my friends again. I had my nature. I had my meditation and spiritual practice. So, you know, and I was just so centered with or without the guy. And, you know, and the guy that I'm with now, Glenn, is so centered. And he was on his own after his divorce for a long time. So I think we both knew the value that being happy first, and then you attract the positive person, you know, the more positive you are. So be the person that you want to attract. I've heard that quote before. So that's
good. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, like, we'll call that like the beginning, even though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. But that's okay. The beginning is always the longest because it's the most meaty junk and it's the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
So now I'd like to talk about the middle, which is you decided then, after having such so many, not just one, but so many life-changing experience, moving dramatically across the world once, twice, three times, and surviving the 2004 tsunami. So what was the final thing that, I suppose it was your ding again telling you to write the book, but what was the final green light, as you were calling it earlier, that made you decide to put pen to paper and start writing the story?
Well, that came around, I think, when I started feeling better about myself. I had let go of some of my guilt about leaving David, and I had kept a lot of journals for when I was, because I'd always liked writing ever since I was in Mrs. Howard's English classes in high school. So, and I thought, you know what, if I'm not very, and when I was happy in Kuwait, I kept my journals because life was so adventurous and cool and wonderful back at that time. And I was paying off college loans and life was great. And then the last 4 years, I tried doing some journaling the first couple of years just because I was unhappy. And I thought maybe I should have an outlet for that. So I took a lot of those journals and then I started looking them over. And I'm like, you know what, this would be great if I could tell a story somehow. And I just started writing right from the very beginning of the first inner ding. And I just kept going. And it's so funny. And that was about 4 years ago. I would say about three. And once I started feeling better, and yeah, and here I am to this day, and I ended up with 400 pages. Yeah. But I think it was just because I was, you know, you think of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, you have a triangle, right?
Yeah.
Where the bottom rungs have got to be, you know, secure before we reach that high level of self-actualization where I'm going to reach these awesome goals and I want to be great and I want to contribute something to the world, you know, but that couldn't happen if I was still in Qatar overseas. I think once I came home, I got rooted back in my environment again. I got rooted into my foundation. I kind of figured out a little bit more about myself and found more joy every day and more of a balance in life that I missed when I was overseas. Once I had those things in place, those bottom rungs, I was able to climb up and start taking more risk, writing, putting pen to paper. Yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And of course, for anyone listening, as of now, we're recording in November 2020, you're querying and you're getting ready to query at least and find agents and publishers. So hopefully when this airs, I'll have a bit of good news. But if not, I'm sure there's some agent out there listening going, oh, I must get in touch with this woman.
Yeah.
So to speak a little bit about your writing, like you're a teacher, same as myself. So where do you fit in your writing? Do you write every day or do you write like every now and then? Like where do you fit it in?
Well, that's the thing too. For writing 400 pages, it was one of those things where, you know, I had to get up. And with my spiritual practice as well, I just started setting my alarm earlier in the morning because I felt like that was when I was at my best. Everybody's got their prime time kind of thing, you know. By the end of the day, I'd always hit the gym on the way home from teaching. And by that time, I was just like, oh. So I think I was getting up at like, I know it's about like 3:30, 4 o'clock every morning.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. I still do. Yeah. So yeah, around 7 o'clock at night, I'm like ready to, you know, fall asleep.
Oh, okay. But... So that's how that works. Okay. Cause I go to bed at like 11:30, 12, and then I get up at 7.
So, okay.
So
okay.
It's a 3. I'm like, whoa, 3 hours sleep. But no, of course you go to bed earlier. That makes more sense.
I end up going to bed around 9, but and I should get more sleep. And that's always been a thing with me. But I just feel like that's my time. And what I will do is I will set like a timer. Mm. Like I have one of those old fashioned kitchen timer things.
Okay.
And yeah. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna get in an hour today or a half an hour. But I think, you know, I think it's just that routine. It was really important to get into a routine. And on the weekends, I would write a lot longer. I would set the timer maybe for 2 or 3 hours. But the timer was kind of nice because I'm like, okay, I only have to write for this amount of time. Or I might set the timer for even 10 minutes. But it was just the fact of having that routine of writing every day. And I know all the gurus about writing, all these people that will always say, it's kind of got to be a routine. Yeah, you know, to get that book done. I mean, there's so many reasons some days not to want to do it. But even if I just sat down and edited for 15 minutes, it's something.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Get that routine established.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like that, it's a very Irish and English saying, but look after the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves.
Okay,
like,
yeah.
You know, like if you just do everything in small doses, that eventually those small doses will become a 400 page book.
Yes.
So to go to the final section of the interview today, are to be continued, because I know it's traditionally beginning, middle, end, but I feel like end is very ominous, so we'll say to be continued instead. Obviously your goals as a writer would be to get the book published, either self-publishing or traditional publishing, but let's say that happens for you, and in 6 months, a year's time, the book is out in bookshops. What's next for you as a writer? Like, what's the next thing you'd like to achieve? Is there another book in you, or is it just this one and done, do you think?
Well, you know, there's always that chance to do like a workbook, like companion type guide, you know, to inner ding type stuff. And another person that I really love is Dr. Susan Jeffers. And she wrote that book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And she was very instrumental in getting my butt back home to the United States, because I was reading that book and she talked about the fear of making a decision. So I want to do like some type of book similar to that, even if it was like for teenagers. There are so many things that I wish I knew now as a teenager that I know now. So So there's always that chance now. And when working with kids, you know, I'll talk about this stuff and then it just goes like right over their head. I wish I could, you know, put out a book, because I think that would have been extremely helpful for me at the time. You know, some more, I think there's got maybe more of these type of things about following your inner ding and thinking bigger. Not just thinking about, like when I was in school, I thought, okay, I'm going to go to this college, it's an hour away. But think even bigger, you know, and when you get out of college, or whether or not you go to college, but think bigger, like out of state or even out of country. There are so many different opportunities out there. And I think sometimes our mind just focuses on what we see and, you know, around us that, you know, and I know the universe had much bigger plans for me, thank goodness, you know, way outside the box than I can ever imagine. But maybe like a teenage type book about following your inner ding and like a workbook type thing, or I'm not quite sure yet. You know, I did write a book already about research skills for kids. So that was more of an academic book that I'm still kind of finishing up as well. So that book's just, that book's done. I had to put that on the back burner because I was, you know, doing my memoir, but that's done as well. So we'll just see what happens. There's a lot of different areas, you know, and I would like to do a little bit of speaking, and you know how you want to do the workshops and go around and public speaking. So we'll see what happens. And I'd love to be back internationally, flying around, talking about all this.
Well, you might have to wait a bit for that with
America, as Americans, my passport, I think I can only go to Mexico. So yeah, I can't go
anywhere. God, is that it?
Yeah, like right now we're like nobody want us.
We all feel it, don't worry. So to kind of to wrap up, I've just my last three questions, and they're the same three questions I end on with everyone. So my first and my last three is, do you have any goals or aspirations that have nothing to do with writing or the book or anything like that that you'd like to share?
You know, I think with like, as far as my goals, I think it's the continuing to, I have something called my squares where I have these nine areas of my life. I got that from Dr. Susan Jeffers. So they're each filled with areas that bring me joy and happiness and balance. I think right now, other than, you know, working with the book stuff, I think it's focusing on those areas. So that's my friends, that's my family, that's my, you know, working out, that's my nature, and keeping my life, my spiritual practice is the biggest thing, and keeping that spiritual practice going. So then once I'm centered and I have that great spiritual practice and I'm feeling good about myself, then I can be that bigger blessing to everyone around my life. So that's a daily thing that will go on forever for in my life. And any other goals I think would be to try to get out and do more traveling type thing, even if it's just within New York State. I know it's really hard right now with COVID. That's really bothering, you know, it's like it's a sacrifice we have to make right now, I guess. You know, we haven't been able to do that, but down the road, that's something that I want to do, even if it's just going over to Massachusetts. I love Massachusetts. So I want to keep going with my traveling when and if this, you know, gets done, and just, you know, working out and enjoying life and staying happy. Those are my big goals right now.
Other than
my
staying happy. That's what more of a goal do you need?
That's right. Yeah. Looking for the joy every day and finding that. Yeah.
My second last question, very easy. Where can people find you online?
Yeah. If you look up Jennifer Benson Author on GoDaddy, I'm on there. So Jennifer Benson Author, and also Jennifer Benson Author on Facebook. Those are probably the two best ones to get a hold of me.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then my final question, and I hope it's easy. What was the last book you read?
I looked at your question ahead of time, so I have an answer for this. I read a lot of different books, but this one really, I loved it. It's called Dare to be Great by Terry Cole Whitaker. And she is another one of those 80s gurus, like Louise Hay, Dr. Susan Jeffers. But I just ran onto her accidentally, but Dare to be Great, like dare to take those risks in life and dare to take those chances. And I even wrote down a quote out of that.
Oh, one.
Courage is the price one must pay for greatness.
That's really good.
It sums it up.
It does. It sums up your entire story as well, in a way. So I can see why you have such an affinity for that quote. Jenny, thank you so much for doing this. It was a blast, and it's this is why I love doing this show, because I get to hear so much and learn so much about people, and the like, it's crazy the stories that I'm hearing and doing this.
Yeah.
Podcast, you know.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for having me on here. I loved it. I loved it. It was wonderful. Brilliant. I really loved talking with you, and yeah, it was great. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed Jennifer's story. I found myself hooked on her every word, and more than anything else, it made me wish for the COVIDian era, as we're calling it, to just end, so I can start traveling the world and see somewhere other than this small Dublin flat that you're listening from. That's pretty much it for me. Be sure to subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're listening on, and check out the YouTube channel too. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a review on whatever podcasting service you're listening on. And if you can't do that, just subscribe on the YouTube page, or better yet, head over to Patreon, where you can even get access to bonus episodes, and once we're starting production, the sneak peek of my audiobook. Yes, so on the Patreon page, I will be uploading each chapter of my audiobook once they're finished, so that you can listen to it as I go. Something I'm really excited about. But in the meantime, find me or the show on Twitter and just let me know what you thought. Just say hi. Just say, hey, I listened to it. You're not talking into the ether. People are out there listening, Connor, and here I am. Here's one of them. So enough about my complaining and woe is me attitude. Hit me up, say hello, and until then, see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya!